comes the sun, little darling, here comes the sun. I say it's all right, it's all right. Here comes the sun.
Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines. This is Manuel Criollo, your co-host here for Voices from the Front Lines. Our fearless leader, Eric Mann, is out doing some self-care over the next 2 weeks. So I'm going to be here on the radio with y'all. And, you know, today's show, we want to really dedicate to three important struggles that are happening across the country. All of them, the theme is about policing in schools and the movement toward ending the presence of police to restrict the role of police in our schools. We're going to go from Baltimore to Columbia, South Carolina to Los Angeles. You know, in Baltimore, we're going to address the recent video clipping of a police officer beating severely a young student in Baltimore schools. We're going to be joined by Jamal Jones. He's the director of the Baltimore Algebra Project, and he was also one of the leaders of the Baltimore United for Change, a coalition that emerged in the wake of the murder of Freddie Gray just a year ago. And then in the second part, we're going to be joined by Efia Ingwanganza, and she is the founder and president of the Malcolm X Center, and also she's actually her own radio personality at WMXPLP Radio 95.5 out in South Carolina. And lastly, we're going to also be joined by Jonathan Stiff. He is the national organizer for the Alliance for Educational Justice, and talking to both about the movement across the country around ending policing in schools, the movement toward ending the school-to-prison pipeline across the country. Here in Los Angeles, of course, you know, I will be joining this conversation from the perspective of the work that the Labor Community Strategy Center has been doing around ending the 1033 and ending the police presence in schools here in Los Angeles. So this show should be really hyped. I'm hoping that everybody stays tuned, listens to a lot of great important speakers. So we'll be right back.
The video lasts only 4 seconds, long enough to show what police are now calling an excessive use of force. Watch again as you see a young man, possibly a student, being slapped 3 times, then kicked by this officer. Officials say this incident occurred Tuesday on the grounds of Reach Partnership High School in Baltimore. Tonight, the officer who works for the Baltimore City...
So that was a clip from CNN about the recent beating that happened in Baltimore at a school out in Baltimore by a school police officer by the Baltimore School Police Department. Of course, as the story has unfolded, the name of the officer has come to light, and his name was Anthony Spence. He's... All right, we're back. Sorry about that. We had some technical difficulties here. As we were saying, as you heard the clip from the CNN clip of the recent video that came to light of the beating of a young black male in Baltimore schools by a Baltimore school police officer, we're joined first by Jonathan Stiff, who is the national organizer for the Alliance for Educational Justice. Maybe we can start there to just give us a landscape about what is the movement that's happening across the country and how these particular, both of these, all these three fights here in Los Angeles, in Baltimore, and in South Carolina are sort of critical places of struggle that will lead to the struggle around ending police in schools. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Oh, can you hear me?
Hey, Jonathan, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
Well, Jonathan, why don't you give our listeners here on Voices from the Front Lines at least, you know, what is the scale of the problem? You know, I think when I talk to a lot of people, especially around my age, you know, now that I'm getting way out there in the older crowd, the idea of police in schools seems very foreign. I mean, I would say probably outside of Los Angeles, which we've had police officers since the 1940s, is not really something that's really well talked about or even addressed. And of course, there's been a growing movement on the ground around what has been coined the school to prison pipeline, and one major sort of branch of that has been to address the criminalization, to address the presence of police. Talk about, at least nationally, what has been this sort of ongoing debate about police in schools, and how is it linked to a broader movement around ending criminalization broadly in the community and sort of ending the forms of different levels of attack that police in our communities present, not just in the schools.
Absolutely. You're asking for a tremendous history lesson here. But I think where we pick up is particularly after Columbine and the desire to police in schools, and after every school shooting, there's this knee-jerk reaction, or at least this pretense of putting police in schools to protect young people. For young people of color, particularly black and brown youth, low-income youth, they don't experience police protection in their schools, and in fact, they experience the kind of treatment that we've seen in Baltimore and then also in Columbia, South Carolina, and then also in Florida with the case of Brittany Overstreet, and even also in Florida with the arrest of Tierra Wilmot for a bot science experiment, and even what we've seen with Ahmed and the clock. And so young people across this country for the last 20 years in terms of trying to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline have also challenged the premise around policing schools. Right there in L.A. with the Youth Justice Coalition, also with young people in New York, they started a movement called You Can't Build Peace with a Peace that tried to challenge the narrative around policing schools and being clear that police only serve and protect the school-to-prison pipeline. And so young people are also offering in that another way. They're calling for restorative or transformative justice that seeks to offer a different way than the punitive racist discriminatory discipline that they experience. And then for a lot of folks, Ferguson was a real grab in terms of also highlighting how militarized our schools have become with the revelation of the 1033 program, particularly in 25 major cities, and that school police, similar to the LA school police, also had access to the 1033 and had acquired tanks, grenade launchers, and all kind of, really armored vehicles. And there's a real question around who are they protecting? And for young people of color, the answer is clearly not them. And for anybody familiar with history, and particularly international history, when you think of, when you saw what was on the ground in Ferguson and think about the 1033 program, I think you have to think about Soweto 76, and we're facing the 50th anniversary of that. And that was simply a language access rally turned into a massacre when met with extreme violence by police. So anyone understanding that history would be really concerned around the 1033, would not see these incidents as isolated events, and that would be clear that we need a comprehensive movement for peace and justice in our schools and in our communities.
Thank you, Jonathan. You are the National Coordinator for Alliance for Educational Justice, a group that's been sort of in the front lines, just like many of the other forums that are across the country, trying to address this issue. One of the things that we've been doing here at the Strategy Center in trying to understand even how the hell did we get to LA School Police Department being involved in this 1033 program, one way that we've been trying to write is this theme about counterinsurgency and war. And, one of the things that's been happening in trying to then sort of uncover their participation, one is that, that as early as 2002, this school police department actually had a SWAT team. You can imagine they had basically a 24-person part-time SWAT team. In theory, when they applied to the 1033 program, they used the excuse that they needed to use it for barricaded suspects, that they needed it for having drug busts in the communities, high-risk warrant searches in communities, right? One of the crazy parts is as we're uncovering the struggle here in Los Angeles against this program, which, of course, none of this has even come out to light from the school police or the LAUSD, which is their responsibility to be telling the public. What comes out is that they were sort of hyping that they're a major sort of drug enforcement agency, right? That they had basically like 21 Jump Street kind of form of police doing, massive arrests on school campuses and on school grounds. That in 2002, they were going to begin a dog sniffing program in LA Unified School District as a way to basically try to sell themselves as this sort of super hyper militarized form in our schools. And the thing that you begin to do, though, is that while you try to understand that within the context of the last, you know, 20, 30 years of what's played out in our schools with, you know, the war on drugs and the war on gangs, which, again, have historically been like a way to attack our communities, the deeper root of even looking at even the police presence in schools here in Los Angeles goes back to two different flashpoints. One is right after the Zoot Zoot riots here, where Black and Latino youth, Black and Mexicano youth, were basically defying what was the norm of what expected of them and started creating, you know, their own sort of subculture of dressing as Zoot Zooters. That right after that time period when there was a massive Zoot Zoot riot, which even wrong to call it a Zoot Zoot riot because in reality it was a white military personnel riot against the Mexican community at that time. They went into Boyle Heights and they went into a lot of the Chicano areas and started beating up people who were wearing Zoot Zoots. That was the first time you saw basically the creation of the school police department here in Los Angeles. And the second root of it was during the height of the 60s when both Black power and Chicano power was in the rise and the role of the movement in the schools. You start seeing basically the introduction of police in the schools as a formal presence in our schools in general. And it's so profound that in some ways we have to see these police not just in the format as 1033, but just their mere presence in our schools itself as a form of counterinsurgency against young people who really have always been, as you sort of used the analogy of Soweto, have been sort of the forefront of fighting for freedom. That even if some of these young people don't even perceive themselves to be the freedom fighters, the system itself already fears them to be those freedom fighters.
Yeah, no, you raise a great point. One of our groups, the Baltimore Algebra Project, they're one of the teachers who work with them, Jake Gilliam, wrote a book, Educating for Insurgency. And he makes the point that the average age of a runaway slave was between 13 and 29. And so historically, you're absolutely right. Black youth and brown youth have represented the most revolutionary transformative element in our struggle. And we're clear, given what we understand the history of police, how it started as slave patrols, that there is this continued dynamic that exists between young people, black and brown young people, and the police, particularly young people, you know, instinctively, impulsively leading for liberation and struggling for freedom, just even almost unconsciously just trying to be, like you said, just trying to wear zoot suits, just trying to express culture, and it gets met with repression. And for us, we understand that as part of the mythicide that also exists in education, some of the ideological domination that occurs that young people rebel against, and that police are there to stem that rebellion and to keep young people in their place and for them to learn their place, that if you don't assimilate, you will go off to jail or you might get shot or you'll get flipped out of your desk, right, and then arrested. And if you stand up, like we saw in the case of Nia Kinney and Shakara in Columbia, that you also will be taken and arrested, you know, for standing up for what is right. So you're absolutely right. There's a clear historical dynamic that exists between young people in this country and the police, or black youth in the police.
Obviously, today we're hoping to dedicate the show to three important sites of struggle. One is in South Carolina, the other one is in Baltimore, and the other one, of course, here in L.A. with a fight around the 1033. Jonathan, I would say, you know, the profound thing that I've always sort of viewed, even in our own movement around ending school to jail track or whatever you want to call it, the school to prison pipeline, the punishment culture in our schools, the miseducation punishment forms that we have in our school systems, it seems to me that in some ways the presence of police has become so entrenched. And while there's been sort of like shock and surprise, for example, like President Obama and his initiative around My Brother's Keeper, or other initiatives by the Department of Education or the Department of Justice that have been trying to address this issue, in some ways there's sort of the elephant in the room where they are, of course, raising that there's disproportionality of the young people who are arrested. Like, if I remember correctly, almost 70% of all the police referrals in schools or arrests are black and brown youth, even though their presence in public schools is not even that high. And likewise, the critique of it as punishing young people at a very young age. But in some ways, what is not often sort of raised is the role that the federal government itself has helped in promoting police in schools. Or again, sort of like, and I know partly as sort of the times has shifted and the debate has shifted, even the police itself is trying to shift their own sort of existence in the school itself, as now as painting themselves as mentors, painting themselves as teachers, or this sort of triad thing about them sort of playing a role both as teacher, mentor, and of course suppressing the hell out of a student.
Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think that was one of the things that grabbed me when I spent some time in Ferguson organizing with young people there. I was like, wow, the same police officer that's shooting tear gas at you is going to be the same police officer that's going to greet you at the school. And so you're absolutely right. And it plays into a lot of different kind of really ideologies have been created in how young people have been criminalized, even going back, you know, to the 90s. With this whole concept of young people being super predators, right? And that's where, you know, that's where you get the war on drugs and the war on crime. But it really wasn't that, and we can see the connection where it's gone in terms of the level of mass incarceration that we see in this country at this moment, and half of it being black and brown folk, and probably a significant portion of them probably snatched up when they were young. So yeah, it flies in the face of history and what we know, and really how police are trained and what they're set to do, regardless of where you find yourself on a political spectrum of whether you believe they're an insurgency or, you know, they're really there to serve and project. I think we all can agree that police don't belong in schools, and they don't belong in schools with guns.
Jonathan, you're the National Coordinator for Alliance for Educational Justice, and I know there's a whole other set of coalitions and forums fighting this issue. What is sort of the parameters of struggles that people are having across this country around this question?
It's really broadened in the last couple of months. I think for the Alliance, we are clear. We say end the war on young people. That we're clear that the police and the school to prison pipeline represent one machination of state violence that has the intent to hurt and harm black and brown young folk. We see a variety of young people fighting in a lot of different ways, from challenging discriminatory school codes, similar to the ones that got that triggered the situation with Shakara, to challenging police in schools, one of my favorites, it was in New Orleans, where, you know, they were organizing under the vision of George Carter, was a young person who was killed on his way to school because there was no neighborhood school in his community, and had to go, you know, it was 100% charter. But he used to talk about dreaming of a world where they had mood detectors instead of metal detectors. And so there is this idea of young people trying to transform education overall and really liberating it and making it a tool to achieve their freedom dreams.
Let's talk about, I know we've been trying to get a hold of here of Jamal about the struggles that are happening out in Baltimore sort of freshly after the release of the video where this police officer was severely beating up a young man and rightfully got caught. And of course, always one of those tricky things where, you know, this is of course a black cop who's beating up on this young black male, and there's another officer right next to them. And of course, at least on one hand, right now, he has been charged there in Baltimore. And there's obviously an investigation that both him and the other officer and the current police chief were all basically put on sort of administrative leave. What's been, I know you're close to Baltimore, what's been the fight looking from you as, you know, both as sort of a person who's been supporting some of the organizing there, but also what you also know of on the ground, because in some ways this comes sort of very fresh of the uprising that happened in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray.
Thinking about this case in comparison to what we've seen with former officer Ben Fields in Columbia, who was not charged. I think there is. I don't make no excuses for the officers who do that, regardless. But there is something to note that the black officers are now, been fired and facing charges. Ben Fields didn't face any charges. In fact, part of the work there has been trying to get the prosecutor to even levy some charges at Ben Fields, you know, after the seeing the video. So I think there's something to be said there around just kind of, again, the maliciousness of the white, you know, white supremacy in this system. But for young people in Baltimore, part of their organizing had been leading up to that, trying to stop the police in schools. This was the first year that it had been implemented. They have been able to get some kind of gap stop where the police weren't allowed to have guns in school, which has probably saved the young man's life at the end of it. And so for them, this was, part of the, like, we told you so, this was what's going to happen. It was also part of a fight that they were trying to divert city funds away from building a new youth prison in Baltimore City and back into the school. Some of the, again, the long history of youth organizing in Baltimore is that the Baltimore Algebra Project won a $1 billion suit against the state of Maryland for funding inequities for years that they have never received. And so you have a state that owes, you know, black children in Baltimore $1 billion in education reparations, but continues to build prisons and put police in schools. And then what we saw, what they were reporting is that after that, you know, some of the city council members were starting to rethink their decision around putting police in school. And you had the Fraternal Order of Police organizing for more police in schools, going to city council saying, hey, we want more police in schools. We want more black, which to me translates to we want to slap more black kids and, in fact, give us our guns and we'll really handle the job. And so there is a very clear struggle that's happening in Baltimore. They're really, you know, fighting for the soul of their city and really trying to make it a city that, you know, really cares for young people and really trying to educate liberation. One of the exciting things I think they won that we didn't see in Spring Valley was they were able to win a restorative justice circle in the school. And so Baltimore Algebra Project had young people who were in the school, and they were quickly able to organize and push the principal to actually stop class and to have a restorative justice conversation with the entire school that happened during homeroom. And I think that's particularly important because, again, what we saw and what we continue to see from the federal government who denounces the school-to-prison pipeline but then funds $90 million worth of police in schools and very little for restorative justice has laid out federal guidelines that really say that the principal is responsible for the conduct of the police officers in the school. And like we saw, again, in Columbia, South Carolina, the principal was not held accountable. Here in Baltimore, thanks to some real tough and strong youth organizing, you had at least young people trying to hold the principal accountable and pushing him to do restorative justice and have that conversation with young people to promote healing and community building. So was really excited about that, but there's still more work to be done in terms of, again, getting police out of schools and really ending this march towards incarceration.
The voice you've been listening to is Jonathan Stiff, and he is the national coordinator of the Alliance for Educational Justice. This is Voices from the Frontlines. This is your co-host, Manuel Criollo. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, and 99.5 in Ridgecrest. And, of course, you can listen to us in the world at kpfk.org. This whole show is going to be dedicated to this conversation, both because, as Jonathan just laid out, this important struggle that's playing out in Baltimore and the struggle that's happening out in South Carolina, down in Spring Valley in Columbia, are sort of both important moments of flashpoints because there was a video. But in reality, you know, we know that this type of brutality, this type of intimidation, this type of even just surveillance and intimidation of our young people is playing out every day. And I think that what we're hoping to have in sort of this next half hours, we are going to be joined in the next half by Ifeah Nwangasa, and she is the founder and president of the Malcolm X Center. And, you know, has been very active in the struggle in Spring Valley and some of the broader questions that has raised in that struggle, not just about this particular cases about the two young women, but in particular what it also has raised about the presence of both police and schools and then even the young people's right to even protest or to use the law in a way that's going to impact young people to even be able to speak and to do the right thing. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to go down to the half, and we'll come back, and Jonathan and Ifeah are going to join us on the show. This is Manuel Criollo, your co-host for Voices from the Front Lines. You know, our fearless leader, Eric Mann, is out having some self-care time for the next 2 weeks, so I'll be your host to try to command this show to talk about some important topics out in the world, to talk about all the revolutionary struggles that are happening around the country and around the world. And, of course, you know, hopefully to bring you some of the most important voices of the movement out in the country and the world. So as you guys heard, we had Jonathan Stiff, who's still on the line with us. He's the National Coordinator of Alliance for Educational Justice. And, you know, this show really was trying to dedicate this whole hour about police presence in schools and how do we end their presence in schools? How do we really begin to turn the tide to the form of criminalization that plays out in our communities and both in our schools, but in some ways the microcosm of the criminalization, the idea of policing schools, militarizing school is all a broader war against black and brown communities that's playing around this country. And one important struggle that, of course, everybody's been following for the last 6 or 7 months has been the struggle out in Spring Valley in Columbia, South Carolina, where again, there was another very explicit video where this officer, Ben Fields, basically turn and beat down a young black woman that, of course, came to light because another young woman had the audacity, really, and the bravery to video clip the moment that this was happening. And, you know, of course, there's been an important struggle that's been happening, but in some ways, again, it's raising a lot of important questions, not just about the particular case, but more importantly about the police presence in schools. And so we're joined by Efia Nwanganza. I'm hoping I'm not botching your name here, Efia. You are the founder and president of Malcolm X Center out in South Carolina. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure and honor to be here.
Efia, I mean, why don't we start just as I started with Jonathan? I mean, what's your take about the presence of police in schools? Help us understand it in the context of a broader struggle that's happening for black people, for all oppressed people in this country around not just the role of the state in fomenting violence or being a presence of violence, but what's really the context of why it even exists?
Well, I began to look at policing generally in this country in addition to military occupation of our communities as the waste bin, employment waste bin for otherwise unfit, largely white male personnel in this country. They throw in some people of color here and there and some women, but across the country, police are largely white males who could otherwise not find a job. So we wind up with being occupied by the least competent persons in the society, and that falls in line with the founding of police departments historically, and that is that as being so-called slave catchers, and they view and the philosophy and mindset is that even today. I would responding more directly to your question, I would say that the whole fear, the perpetration of fear in this society has been used as a mechanism for all kinds of excuses to quote unquote make the American people feel safe. Of course, students who are subject to these abuses do not feel safe. In fact, in the case of Spring Valley, Ben Fields was known throughout the school as Officer Slam because he had a reputation of abuse. He had been noted to have assaulted a U.S. veteran who lived in the area near the school, not only assaulted the veteran who was coming home from work and in an apartment complex where Fields thought a black man should not be, but Fields also assaulted the man's wife when she came out and objected to his throwing down the rug onto the pavement and handcuffing him. He was known at the school to have assaulted a mother who was pregnant at the time for objecting to an assault on her son. So this man had a reputation for being abusive. He was known to the administrators, the principal, the disciplinarians, the staff, and the student body as being abusive. In fact, we obtained and submitted to the United Nations Working Group of Experts on the Status of People of African Descent in the United States, and who were taking testimony in Jackson, Mississippi, back in January, an interview that was done with a young lady who had graduated from Spring Valley about 6 years ago. She's now a graduating senior at Clemson University, and she talked about how when she was there as a youngster, a teenager, that she believed that there was something wrong with this man, that he, on one hand, could be very nice, very helpful, very cooperative, and on a dime, he could become Officer Slam. And that she went home and told her parents about it, and their response was, stay out of his way. Now, that brings me to another point about the community's responsibility to prioritize our children as number one, and when we are getting, whether we're getting a cue or not, that we are present and supporting them in advancing their resistance and their defense against this intimidation, bullying, physical and psychological assaults. I see the bringing of cops into the schools post-Columbine, where, as I understand it, still does not have cops in the school, which the principal at that time resisted, saying that cops were not needed, counselors were, and other support services were needed for children, not guns and uniforms. We find that Columbine wound up being the excuse for expanding the occupation of our communities. Schools were the only place where there was some refuge from law enforcement or militarization, without discussing the content of the curriculum. But at least until Columbine, the students were not subject to metal detectors, they were not subject to police dogs, they were not subject to patrols and the like. Following Columbine, it became schools became a convenient target for the expansion of the militarization of this society generally and of our communities in particular. So to be able to beat back this new front is critical at this point in time, because more often or more students are actually impacted by their presence and the criminalization of typical child, adolescent, young adult behavior affects far more students than even the ones who are actually physically abused. In the case of Shakara and Naya, we see that their whole lives have been turned upside down. Shakara has been put into isolation, silenced, removed from her peers, and unable to interact and to develop socially in an appropriate manner. And we see Naya having been criminalized, both of them being charged with disturbing school. Shakara, who was put into a chokehold, body slammed by a 300-pound white male sheriff's deputy who reportedly bench presses 600 pounds, is charged with, in addition to disturbing school, assault on a police officer. He has not been charged at all. And as far as we know, he may even be at some other school traumatizing the students at that school. So the question becomes, what are we to do at this point in time that will get cops out of the schools, counselors in the school, and restore at least a quasi-safe and nurturing environment for all students?
Thank you. That voice that you just heard is Afia Nwangaza. She is the founder and president of Malcolm X Center. You're in Greenville, South Carolina. Is that right,
Afia? Yeah, that's correct.
And, you know, she has been obviously a long time freedom fighter and, of course, has been very involved in the struggle around Shakara and Naya out in the case of Spring Valley of the attack by this officer, Ben Fields, on Shakara, and as she just laid out, impacting both young women, both of them facing charges by the system against them, even though they're the ones that were harmed. One place I wanted to talk about that you raised right now, Afia, and I know because you've been in South Carolina for a long time, is this idea of disturbing the schools. You know, here in Los Angeles, we've had a struggle around two forms of that. One has been the way that particularly black youth were being suspended under this sort of thing called willful defiance, right? And I often think that it comes out of a, you know, very slave sort of society for you to say somebody's being willfully defiant. And of course, you know, while a lot of people talked about disproportionality, I don't even like that term because, you know, black students here in LA Unified are probably about 8% of the population, but, you know, we're up to almost 40% of those who are getting suspended under this sort of loose category. And on the flip side, for those who weren't getting just suspended, some were getting both ticketed and arrested for disturbing the peace, right? And that could have been for a whole variety of things, from fights to, you know, you just acted up or whatever. But using, and again, almost virtually the same number. I mean, you know, again, when we talk about disproportionality, I know it's trying to make an argument to say how jacked up stuff is. But in reality, when we look at it from a bigger point of view, you know, when you look at, that's the same percentage that you see black youth, black adults, black people in the community being harassed and policed by police and other forms. Can no longer just be disproportionate because they're the same people. And
right.
I guess why don't we go into this issue about disturbing the schools as a penal code inside the schools, which if I understood correctly, this comes out of the struggle against segregation in South Carolina, and now it's being used against these young women.
Exactly. And I think that first of all, to recognize that all of these charges are subjective.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, what is defiance to mm-hmm. one person is assertiveness for another. It's kind of the double standard that is readily recognized as it relates to women. In some instances, you know, a woman is considered a nag, but in other instances, depending on her race and who's the subject of the attention, then she is being attentive. And the same applies for these subjective charges that are being applied. And we find instances where black girls who are punished more frequently and more severely than any other girls in the public school systems, even as compared with black males. More often and more severely, we have instances where black girls are suspended from school for rolling their eyes at the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I mean, what kind of threat is a girl rolling her eyes at least a purported adult? So that's one. Two is historically, you're correct when you say that it has its roots in slavery. And more to the point, it has its roots in the continuing global system of white supremacy. And that is that no one or nothing is to challenge the authority of white folk generally, and of policies put in place even when enforced by people of color. The ultimate goal being to retain power and control over the society, and with early training and seasoning of young people in school. We look at situations where a six-year-old child in Florida is handcuffed because she has a temper tantrum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's obvious that the teacher in that classroom was not competent, or that the teacher in that classroom had an agenda that was not in the best interest of that child or any other child of color. I would say to you, coming from the South, looking at from the South and the rest of the country, is an ongoing effort to restore segregation in the public school system. So that every kind of mechanism possible is being used in order to first of all separate within the school building itself white students and students of color. Secondly, to drive students of color out of the school system itself. Our research shows that in the year of school year of 2012 to 13, over 57,000 black children from preschool through high school were paddled or some form of corporal experienced some form of corporal punishment in the public school system. Now, what 17-year-old is going to tolerate being paddled by even some black male who's been hired for that purpose?
Mm-hmm.
Not many. So the whole process is as a Chinese scholar sitting on the as an expert at the United Nations Human Rights Council doing a review of the United States for the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination pointed out, it appears that it has again become unlawful for black and brown children to be educated in the United States.
That is the voice of Afia Nwanganza. She is the founder and president of the Malcolm X Center out in Greenville, South Carolina. You know, this whole show has been to try to address the presence of police, really, in some ways. How do we perceive this not just as sort of an anomaly of a decaying society, but in reality, it's a very designed format of suppression and repression. And one of the profound things that is happening across the country that I've seen is obviously there has been a growing pushback and movement against the presence of police. Much of it at this moment has been about curbing their presence. In other words, decriminalizing how young people are being treated in school. And obviously here at the Strategy Center, we've done a lot of that important work. You know, we've seen almost a 92% reduction of tickets and arrests happening here in LA Unified. But in reality, though, in some ways, it's been a negotiated moment, because in reality, they still have 500 officers in the schools. They still have a $60 million budget. They still have guns. And what we saw both in the case in Baltimore and the case in Spring Valley, we might not have full videos, even though we did have a case where one young man, Jeremy Marks, about 7-8 years ago, did the same thing that Naya did, which was to film a school police officer beating one of his classmates. And in fact, he's the one that got arrested. And he was being charged for this lynching of a police officer, and spent almost 6 months in jail because the family didn't have enough money to release him for bail, who had just turned 18 and spent, you know, six months in jail. You know, we have about, you know, a couple of minutes. I know Jonathan's still on the line. Why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, where you know, what could people do? How can people help? I know here in Los Angeles, there's an important battle against the LA Unified to, you know, demilitarize that department. We have a demand around a reparations for all the harm they've done over the last, you know, really the last 60 years, but in reality, of course, the last 10 years around criminalizing young people in schools, and of course, their latest participation in the 1033 program. And while we've been able to force them to symbolically return those weapons, there's still a lot of questions answered about why were they participating in the program. There's not even a full account, no full inventory, no real apology, no way to even repair the harm that they've already caused. Both for you, Ife, and for Jonathan, what are some of the things that you guys are working on, and how can people help?
Well, one of the requirements that two things that
and we got 2 minutes.
We're working on immediately, and that is we want people to call Dan Johnson's office, who Dan Johnson is the solicitor for Columbia, South Carolina, to demand that Ben Fields be prosecuted, reminding him that Baltimore has been able to respond and that he can no longer hide behind a DOJ investigation that has been going on for months at this point in time. Second thing is that to call upon the head of the Department of Education, for U.S. Department of Education, to require schools to, in fact, collect and disaggregate data by gender and race to establish counseling and other effective conflict intervention strategies sensitive to the needs of students generally and of girls as well as boys in particular. That there's a record kept of the number of the students by gender and race and activity that are taken, are arrested at school, or in your case, summons at school, so that analysis can be made of the conduct of the officers, and above all, that they ultimately remove the cops from the schools and replace them with counselors.
Thank you, Efia. That's Efia Nwanganza. She's the founder and president of Malcolm X Center. We also were joined by Jonathan Stiff. He's the national coordinator of Alliance for Educational Justice. Please check out their work. Also, we were meant to have Jamal Jones, director of the Baltimore Algebra Project. This is Manuel Criollo from Voices from the Front Lines. I really want to thank Gary Baca. He's our board operator. Please follow us at Eric Mann Speaks on Twitter. Also, you know, we love emails. So, folks, really, if you want to hear about any of these, the important, incredible work that's being done across the country and here in Los Angeles, please email us at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Thanks again for joining Voices from the Front Lines. See you next week.